Dirty money piled on the table. A glory shot. Everyone loves it. The stacks, the seal, the raid jacket. The picture that makes the evening news. Hell, as an investigator, I begrudgingly followed a boss's orders to stage such shots on more than one occasion, long after the fact, to capture an already past moment for internal agency posterity and for the evening news. What nobody photographs is what happens 18 months later. Whether that money made it back to a victim, whether the criminals even noticed it was gone, whether it made any inkling of a difference, whether we just moved a pile of paper from one vault to another and called it victory. My guest today has spent her career on that second question, the one the cameras never capture. I've spent a good part of mine on the first. This is Cease and Desist. I'm Jason Sandoval. If you're new here, this show isn't about managing clean money. It's about chasing and nabbing dirty money. We talk about how that money hides and moves, how we take it, and the far more awkward question of what actually taking it accomplishes and looks like. Our guest today has done something rare in this field. She went and gathered real evidence. Dr. Amber Phillips is a senior lecturer in criminology at the University of the West of England in Bristol. She specializes in organized and economic crime. Her interest in this space didn't start in a library. It started at the tip of the boot in Calabria, Italy, the home turf of one of the world's most notorious criminal organizations, 'Ndrangheta. There, she was embedded with anti-mafia organizations. Amber's study, Beyond the Figures, is built on in-depth interviews with 29 financial investigators across England and Wales. It says some things people writing the press releases might not love. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jason. So I came to asset recovery entirely by accident. I became a criminologist entirely by accident. And that was down, as you said, to my experience in Calabria. So I showed up in Calabria in 2012 as a translator with absolutely no knowledge of organised crime, of economic crime, of anything really. I was there to translate. While I was there, I was working alongside people who were using confiscated mafia assets, so specifically real estate, so great big showy mafia pieces of property, big villas that had once belonged to local mafia bosses. And the people I was working with were using those confiscated assets for good. They were endeavouring to turn a piece of mafia property into something that benefited the whole community, which is work that requires an enormous amount of patience and dedication and love and commitment to your community. And it's very difficult, I think, not to be deeply inspired by that. And that was the point at which I first realised that asset recovery existed. And like a lot of people working in this space, I think a lot of people that I speak to at every end of the asset recovery process, it really gets people. It's something that you can invest in. It's something to get passionate about because it appeals to something quite basic in the human spirit, I think. This handing over of something that was being used for nefarious purposes and doing something really positive with it. And it's something that really captures the imagination. So I came back from that experience absolutely hooked, knowing that I wanted to do something with my life, with my career, that would let me get more involved in this space. And sort of 10, 15 years down the line, this is the focus of my research. So the social reuse of assets, what we do with the assets once they've been confiscated, but also the asset recovery process more broadly. So I've written about the context in Italy, which is where my love affair with asset recovery began. But now I'm very much focused on the context in England and Wales. And that's what this latest project is about.
Outstanding. I mean, it's fascinating that from technical work in Calabria, you become this very well-known criminologist in this space. But I'll give you a little bit of background on myself, throw my cards on the table. So you, as well as the listeners, kind of know what seat I'm speaking from. You know, I spent 30 years chasing this dirty money around the world. I had permanent postings in Sinaloa, in Kabul, in Istanbul, and also in Rome. I spent a lot of temporary assignments many other places, and it was many different corners of the same business. The through line in almost every single one of them was the money. And it was quite often the money that wasn't seized or recovered, the money, as we would say, left on the table. And here's the thing that I can only now see in retrospect with respect to all of that. Those places I visited were partial pictures of an effort formed by the same disjointed, dare I say, dysfunctional network of good guys chasing well-funded, increasingly sophisticated, effective, and often allied bad guys. I witnessed firsthand, you know, that collaboration was most often relegated to one and two-dimensional cookie-cutter processes to address multidimensional, ever-evolving threats. I don't want this to sound negative, but it's kind of postmortems on my career. You know, we built cathedrals of expertise. You know, we were experts in our field, but only in our silo. And that led a prosecutor friend of mine once to call these silos of excellence, which I thought was funny, but it was true. So the criminal organizations we were pursuing probably didn't care one iota about the walls we put up between us as the good guys. In fact, they probably would have celebrated our intransigence and resistance to embrace transparency and true collaboration. So I'm giving you that as my scene setter. I'm going to turn to you because my last tour as an DEA agent was in Rome, Italy. And the target I cared most about, ironically, for our discussion today was 'Ndrangheta. Others refer to it as the Calabrian Mafia.
Yeah.
So as you laid out in your opening sequence here, your superhero origin story, and I'll call you a superhero because not everybody gets inspired the same way you do. It began there in Calabria, embedded with anti-mafia organizations. You're an observer that was inspired to turn academic and make a difference in this space that truly, as I've seen both as a public official and now in the private sector, has way too few people seeking holistic solutions. So let's start there, Amber. Mm-hmm. You champion change in the paradigm surrounding proceeds of crime and their use once they've been adjudicated by the court. You worked alongside anti-mafia organizations and not with the data set. You stared the criminal problem set in the face, whether you were in a technical role or directly an organizer. And 'Ndrangheta was literally at your doorstep. What did that experience teach you about asset recovery that could never have been observed from numbers on a computer screen?
I think the power of idealism is a big part of this. I think certainly with an organization like the 'Ndrangheta, which is so old and so embedded and so powerful and extensive globally, taking it on in the first place is something that you only do if you've got a streak of idealism. And that was certainly true of the people that I was working with, and I'm very proud to still call my friends. So you have to have a vision, you have to believe that something better is possible, and you have to throw everything in the kitchen sink at it and be prepared for there to be failures and frustrations along the way, of which there are plenty, but not give up. And I suppose the difference in my approach to all of this is that I started at the beginning of my career, if we can call it that, with the destination phase. So a lot of the asset recovery professionals that I'm speaking to, perhaps yourself included, with all of the operational experience, are approaching it from a different angle. But I started with the destination and I started with this idealism. So I'm viewing the whole thing from perhaps a slightly different perspective. I remain a hopeless idealist. So I have an idea of what is possible and what can be done. And I think that keeps me going and a lot of people going, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, okay, let's help our listeners conceptualize what impact looks like. Mm. In a place like Calabria, which we'll talk a little bit about one of my postings a little bit, Sinaloa, Calabria actually reminds me a lot of Sinaloa in certain ways, which when I say that, sometimes Italians cringe at me, Italian friends of mine. But there in Calabria, when the state seizes an asset, often in 'Ndrangheta, a building, a business, a plot of land, who's actually feeling that? Who benefits? Who loses? Does the community even know what happened?
A really good question. I feel compelled to say that I love Calabria. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world. I care for it immensely, and it gets a really bad rap in a lot of media reports. So I do need to stick that flag in the ground before I go on. But mafias thrive, as you'll be aware, mafias thrive in areas where there's already very low public confidence in state institutions. And this is long held. And in the case of the Italian mafias, goes back over a century. This is really deeply embedded stuff. And this is what helps embed their power in the first place. So if we look at mafia power as being built on two central pillars, one of those is territorial control and governance, and the other is a level of social consensus in the communities that they're governing. And that can be achieved in a few different ways. For example, providing employment opportunities where historically these have been few and far between. Or off the top of my head, an example you might have seen in the press a few years ago during COVID, some of the Sicilian mafia groups were handing out food parcels where people were, you know, hard up and out of work. They're not doing this out of the good of their hearts. These are not benevolent organizations. They're setting themselves up as an alternative to state power. They're saying, we govern this area, we are in control, we are in a position to help because this is our territory. And this is a really important foundation for understanding how mafias work. So asset recovery is geared specifically at undermining those two pillars of mafia power. So with asset recovery, if we look, for example, at real estate, if you've got a big piece of impressive real estate, that is a physical, tangible manifestation of that particular mafia group's power. It's saying, we live in this area, this is a physical manifestation of our wealth and our power. So conversely, by taking that big status symbol away from that mafia group, you are showing to the community, this no longer belongs to these people. We are giving this to the community. So symbolically, that transfer of power can be quite meaningful. Similarly with businesses, which can also be confiscated. If a mafia group is running a business, providing jobs to local people, taking that business away and putting it into the hands of the workers can be very beneficial for the community, because the mafia group will not have been abiding by safety protocols. They won't have been disposing of their waste safely. They won't have been paying social security contributions. So it's about showing a community that has been terrorized by mafia power for time immemorial that there is another way, and that power can be transferred into community hands via the medium of the state. That's what asset recovery is for. There's a couple of caveats here. I was talking earlier about how, you know, I'm an idealist. I've seen that these projects can work enormously well. So there are examples like Goel in Calabria, which are running ethical, sustainable businesses on land, agricultural land that's been confiscated from mafia groups, and that's sustainable. It's providing jobs for local people. It's a fantastic model of it going well. But there are obviously a lot of challenges. So confiscating that piece of mafia real estate from the local boss and giving it to a community group does not overnight erase the territorial control and the fear, frankly, in the local population. So just signing a piece of paper and transferring the asset over doesn't mean that the local population feels safe to go and use it without fear of reprisals from the mafia group. So this transfer takes time and investment, not financial investment alone, but also investment in people's trust, building trust among the community, showing them that it's safe, showing that promises will be kept, that the state will fulfill its side of the bargain and provide protection and uphold its promises. So it's slow burn. It takes time. It's winning hearts and minds, perhaps is the phrase to use. It's slow, it's arduous, it takes a lot of time. There are setbacks, but it can work really well. And sorry, one of the questions you asked me was, does the community know it happened? And the answer is yes, but whether they automatically feel safe to then use that confiscated asset is another question. That's the thing that requires the time and the investment.
You know, I actually saw it firsthand visiting Calabria on multiple occasions during my tour in Italy. And I actually visited Goel's sustainable farm.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was towards the end of my career. It was like literally the last few months of my career, but I was just so fascinated by the project. And I realized the same thing I realized in many of these spaces around the world, that the problem at its core, when you have criminal organizations essentially as the main rival, if not a superseding entity of state power, it really is socioeconomic at its core. And Goel really took the concept of turning the idea that the only alternatives were state power or mafia power and kind of used private enterprise as a means to sort of drive change, which is fascinating to me. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of that organization. So I look at it not only as state power, but private enterprise that has an ethical sense of, or an ethical or moral compass driving their action. They take these lands. You can visibly see a farm, a co-op, a community center on land that arguably the mafia laid claim to years ago, or the state seized and then gave to that private entity to run as they saw fit, you know, that social reuse. When you saw that working in real time, what was inspiring about that? What clicked in your brain that made you think, this is what I want to research, this is what I want to make my career of?
I think you need a heart of stone not to be inspired by that. I think it's I think social reuse is inherently inspiring, isn't it? It's on a human level, I said in the intro, it's compelling. this narrative. Humans love narratives. We love stories. And it's a beautiful story with a lovely ending, theoretically. It's doing something constructive and positive with the proceeds of something which is the opposite of those things. Mafias are corrosive to their communities in so many ways. And there's also, I think, an alignment to an extent with restorative justice here, in that social reuse acknowledges society as a victim of crime, which is really relevant when we look at mafia type groups, because as I said, they're inherently corrosive to the societies that they're trying to govern. So if we acknowledge society as a victim of crime, it changes the whole way that we approach asset recovery. I mean, with offences, I mean, shifting back again to the UK context, like we're looking at offences like fraud. Obviously, there's often a very clear identifiable victim or group of victims, in which case we talk about compensation. But there are plenty of offences here as well, where there isn't a clearly identifiable individual victim. We can look at drugs offences or counterfeiting offences. The harm is to society itself or to the taxpayer or to the public purse. So if we start seeing the community and society as a victim, then we start thinking about, okay, well, how can we constructively use the proceeds of crime then to benefit society and acknowledge that it's been damaged and undermined by these offences?
So much of this rings true to different phases in my career, if not every phase in my career. Years ago, and I won't tell you how many years ago, my kind of initial observation, sort of my origin story, and I won't call myself a superhero like I call you, with respect to asset recovery, began in Sinaloa. And there I saw, unlike Ndrangheta, the cartel really wasn't hiding from the community. To a degree, it was the community. It was like the employer, the bank, the developer, was often the police. And in a half-hearted effort to sort of conceal their ownership, cartel leaders were essentially the beneficial owners of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of properties and businesses across Sinaloa, Durango, and other neighboring states of Mexico. And the federal government of Mexico had left a vacuum there in these kind of underserved areas of the country. The cartel readily filled them. The local population in the cartels, ironically, occupied a common demographic. They all hailed from the same places. Just some of them were cartel and some of them were just civilians. And they were essentially a marginalized class that the state left behind. This socioeconomic reality manifested itself best, in my opinion, in their worship of Jesus Malverde, who was a patron saint of the working class, kind of the poor class. And he was kind of considered an angel of the poor or a generous bandit. And there were certain cartel leaders, Chapo Guzman in particular, who sort of, I think, reckoned himself something of a modern day Jesus Malverde in the flesh. These early observations colored my perception in that space to reckon seizure, taking away the ill-gotten gains, ill-gotten assets, as the win. And now, as I'm listening to you, it's not really the win, truthfully, Amber. It's what happens afterwards. It's to refill the vacuum with forces for good, to fund those efforts with the proceeds the criminal once flaunted in the same geography. So thinking about that and the implementation of that, the government's asset recovery framework often runs on four objectives, as I think you've pointed out, and maybe others have as well. Disrupt, deprive, discredit, deter. Four Ds. You prescribe that a fifth D is needed. Destination. When did you decide that destination mattered as much as seizure? What's missing right now and what actually changes if where it ends up becomes codified as a metric of success?
Everything goes back to my experience in Italy, I suppose, because it's about the way we conceptualize asset recovery at its most basic level. It's what are we doing this for? Why are we taking the assets away? And this is quite visible. If you look at the FATF asset recovery guidance that they published last year, 2025, reading that was quite an interesting experience because I'd spent quite a lot of time embedded in the UK government policy papers around asset recovery and what it's for and the debates there are around what are we doing this for. And the framing that FATF used was subtly different. So they talk in that guidance about the role of asset recovery as, quote, a path for restoration for victims, end quote. And longer term, they talk about wider national economic benefits of asset recovery, including reinvestment in communities. And what's significant about that for me is that they are framing asset recovery in terms of benefits rather than objectives. And it's a subtle distinction, but it's quite an important one because it belies a slightly different way of thinking about the process of asset recovery. And I suppose it's about thinking about the story or the process. So asset recovery is a long process. We could say it starts with the offence, or we can say that it starts with the investigation, but it's not over until those funds end up somewhere. And that's a part of the story that is missing, I think, from a lot of the way that the UK conceptualise. I say the UK, I mean England and Wales, because obviously the situation in Scotland is slightly different. But ultimately, if you stop thinking about asset recovery with a figure, so an amount that's been recovered or a number of orders that you've obtained, you haven't fully addressed the why are we doing it? What's the goal? And you're missing quite a big part of the story because you are missing the ending. You are missing the impact. You are missing the outcome. So what's ultimately going to happen as a result of this? And if you look at some of the early policy documentation around this, so the PIU report published in the year 2000, so 2 years before the Proceeds of Crime Act came out, that talks a lot about a whole different range of goals for asset recovery, including inspiring public confidence in law enforcement. How do you measure that? And undermining negative role models in the community, which is still one of the 4Ds. But again, this is really difficult to measure in figures. And I think destination, so the end point of where that money ends up, gets lost quite easily because you can get into a situation of what's measured is what matters, or what's measurable is what matters. And if we can't measure these things, well, let's just not bother engaging with them so much, and they just slip down the priority list. So it's about mindset, I think. The other thing to mention, perhaps a bit tangential, but it's worth pointing out, is that we don't demand profitability from any other areas of law enforcement or policing, but for some reason we do when it comes to asset recovery, because it's an option to bring money in. But we don't consider any other areas of law enforcement in terms of its ability to make a profit. We consider its wider social benefits. So why are we losing sight of those with regard to asset recovery? Because they're just as important, but they, for some reason, they get lost. They're less of a part of a conversation. And I think bringing them back into the conversation is probably the main goal behind the work that I've just done.
It's fascinating to me because I often watch political processes in the States, in Europe, UK, and I see politicians on every side of the aisle arguing over tax increases for, you know, this pet project or that pet project. And I think about the billions in revenue that exists in the criminal space. And if we put a focus on asset seizure, asset recovery, and social reuse using criminal proceeds, and gave a real effort to identify criminal assets during investigations, I don't even think we'd ever have to talk about raising taxes again. Truthfully, I think we could talk about lowering taxes. And I think simultaneously, once that became an operating policy, you would probably bring down criminal activity at the same time, because people would realize crime truly didn't pay. So let's talk about beyond the figures. You took some in-depth takeaways from 29 financial investigators across England and Wales. What did they tell you that wasn't showing up anywhere in the data and official numbers?
So the big research question that I came into the project with was, what are some of the different ways that success looks like in asset recovery? And are there measures of success, ways of thinking about success that aren't easily represented by figures? And the answer was yes. That's not to say that financial investigators that I spoke to were completely indifferent to big numbers. That's not true. But what they did tell me was that there are a lot of areas of impact coming out of their work that are not adequately reflected by figures. And there were three in particular that stood out. So the first one was disruption and specific deterrence. So what I mean by that, I suppose, is that you cannot quantify crimes that are not committed as a result of these interventions. But that is something that's quite highly valued by some investigators. So there's a quote from one of my participants that sums this up quite nicely. So she's a police officer, financial investigator, working out on division in a police force in one of the cities in the UK. And she said, "For me, it's not around the value of the confiscation order, it's around the impact." She said, "Taking £1,000 off someone could be just as impactful as taking £100,000 off someone. It's all relative depending on where they fit into that criminal cycle." So this was really interesting to me because it offers a counter narrative to one of the big critiques of asset recovery that you find in a lot of academic literature. So a lot of the criticism, certainly of confiscation in England and Wales, has focused on a decontextualized set of quantitative data that looks at the number and amount of confiscation orders and says, look, okay, we've got a high number of quite low value confiscation orders. And that means that the Proceeds of Crime Act isn't doing what it was intended to do because we're targeting the small fish, basically. We should be going after the big fish and we're targeting the small fish. And this research offers a counter narrative to that because it's saying that actually, for some investigators, certainly those working out in the communities, living in the communities that they're serving, for them, lots of lower value orders means interrupting criminal careers of people that might go on to become the big fish in another few years' time. And that, I mean, it needs bearing out. It needs more investigation in future research. But as a sort of headline finding, that to me was extremely interesting because it shows that, again, the value of the order, the amount of the order, does not necessarily reflect the impact that it's going to have in a particular community.
I recall an example in your report that, I don't know, it resonated with me maybe a little bit just because I had something similar happen early in my career. A van gets stopped, 75 to 100 grand in cash in the back. I think it was a traffic stop, if I'm not mistaken. No investigation, no real work. And the bosses fall all over themselves to send attaboy emails to the investigator or investigators. Meanwhile, simultaneously, someone's running this complex long-term investigation that leads to confiscation. It lasts for years. They use legislation nobody's ever touched, probably never even heard of before. And upper management doesn't even give them a nod. Is that just human nature chasing the big number for, you know, the splash with the bureaucracy or the splash with the press? Or is that indicative of a measurement system that's actively broken?
That was so interesting, that example. And that wasn't the only example I heard from people who had even, they'd received awards and commendations for bringing in the big numbers and felt sad. You don't often hear about people feeling sad about getting a reward, but they felt that these rewards were hollow because they were not acknowledging the depth and the work that had gone into the investigation, as you said. And that, I mean, going back to the ways of measuring success that you can't capture in figures. So the first one was disruption and deterrence. Another one was doing a job well. So people felt that for them, doing a job exhaustively, leaving no stone unturned, looking at everything they possibly could, it was a measure of doing a job well, of a successful investigation, but it wasn't necessarily being recognized by their senior managers. And if you ask the financial investigators, I mean, a lot of the people that I spoke to felt that that was down to a lack of understanding on the part of senior managers. And to a degree, this is understandable because the police have got a lot on their plate. I don't think there's ever been a point in history where they haven't had a lot on their plate, but certainly the resource pressures now are really biting. There's a lot of competing priorities. There's very little resource to do it with. But certainly a recurring theme was that there is a lack of appreciation of what the Proceeds of Crime Act is, of what financial investigation is. And if you don't understand someone's job, then you can't reward them for doing it well. And that certainly came up a lot. But again, it's a pretty challenging time in policing. So,
you know, those takeaways, they put a chill down my spine at first, and then they pushed a button for me because, you know, I recall cases where there was a lot of work, a lot of man hours put into it. And, you know, we took some bad guys off the street. We see some assets, but it was certainly no, you know, it wasn't in the millions. It was like the tens of thousands. And then some guy's down at the Amtrak train and takes off 2 million and you'd think he took off Pablo Escobar. So, you know, both have a value to them, but I think the big splash is something that you can call the boss and the boss can call the boss and they can call headquarters and everybody's, oh, $2 million at the train station.
But numbers don't tell a story. I mean, that's if I had to give a headline for the whole research, there's a beautiful quote from one of the participants, which is that numbers don't tell a story. And if you just send through a spreadsheet and the spreadsheet is all the person looks at, then naturally they're just going to look at the figure. But again, it always comes back to a story because the number doesn't tell you the impact on the community, on the individual, on the team that's got that result, or on the revisit. So the amount that might ultimately come in, if you've got a nominal order, for example, and you're going back to revisit that, it's a much longer story than that single line in a spreadsheet can ever possibly represent.
Absolutely. Talking about the financial investigators, this was always something that I struggled with during my career, you know, and in your report, you actually talk about financial investigators as somehow the most siloed persons in the building. One police force cited in your study referred to the financial unit as practicing the, and I quote, mysterious dark arts, end quote. And I watched that exact fracture in my career. You know, separate expertise created for different facets of the same predicate offenses, especially the financial component of the predicate offense, as if these were two separate crimes. And to a degree, they are two separate crimes, but one doesn't exist without the other, obviously. And I watched that divide grow ever wider as new technologies such as e-currency and crypto came to redefine finance in the last 20 years. Agencies were often chasing pieces of the same criminal networks, but they couldn't or wouldn't see each other's peace. And I don't know if that, again, is like a part of human nature that they don't want to cede their control, cede their part of the broader picture in the interest of the of mission, which is a word I often use. So to help that, you're conducting your study and you've just secured funding from the NCA and from the Home Office through the Asset Recovery Incentivization Scheme, or ARIS, to study whether asset recovery actually deters offenders and disrupts criminal networks. Can you explain ARIS, how it works, what it funds, and why it's being used to fund this research and how that's notable?
So ARIS was introduced back, I think, in 2006. And it's basically the way that the government disseminates the money that's been recovered. So the first thing to say is that 50% of it goes straight to the Home Office, and they do what they do with it. And then out of that, there's something called top slice funding, which I think is what my project has been funded through. And that was introduced back in, I think, 2015. And that's obtained by deducting a percentage from the total amount that's remitted to the Home Office, which is about £14 million, I think, is ring fenced for that annually. And that can be bid for. So project-based grants can be bid for by various different agencies for that top slice funding. And then the remaining 50% gets divided up depending on a couple of factors. So for confiscation orders, that 50% remaining gets split three ways. So 18.75% goes to the investigating authority, which is often the police, but not always. 18.75% goes to the prosecuting authority, which is often the Crown Prosecution Service. And then 12.5% goes to enforcement, which is HMCTS. So that's for confiscation orders. For forfeiture orders, so the civil route, the breakdown looks a bit different. So in forfeiture orders, it's split 50-50. So 50% goes to the lead agency. So what that translates to, so after the fog of figures there, what that basically means in real terms is that you get less money back from confiscation orders than you do from forfeiture orders. And that is significant because certainly one of the findings from my research was that some financial investigators that I spoke to were expressing frustration that they wanted to go for a confiscation order because they felt that, and I'm quoting again, confiscation orders were the gold standard. They were more holistic, they were more powerful, they would get the result that the investigators wanted, but they were being pressured not to go down the confiscation route because a forfeiture order would be more lucrative. And that's in the context of budgetary pressures and resourcing issues. So that's an issue if the investigators are wanting to go the confiscation route, but they're being dissuaded from doing so or prevented from doing so because, and the other thing is that confiscations are happening post-conviction and prosecution is expensive. So certainly, I mean, the Proceeds of Crime Act can be used by all sorts of different authorities in England and Wales. So it's not just police forces, it's also things like local councils, trading standards, and local councils can't use the CPS. So they're having to pay for their own prosecutions, which again is an obstacle to getting a confiscation order because you'd have to pay for that prosecution first. So that sort of diverted me a little bit from ARIS, but it's just to say that the amount of money that's coming back to the agency is not consistent necessarily. So in terms of where that money goes, so once you've got your return, your 18.75% of the total or whatever, the way that's spent looks a bit different depending on where you are in the country. So the Home Office says on the Home Office website, it says it encourages agencies to invest ARIS funds to drive up performance on asset recovery or where appropriate to fund local crime fighting priorities for the benefit of the community, which is another way of saying social reuse in my idealistic brain. And there is some social reuse going on in the UK. It is happening. So there are places. So West Yorkshire is the one I always bang on about because I'm a bit obsessed with the work that they're doing. So West Yorkshire have got a Mayor's Safer Community Fund. So their ARIS money is being spent on causes that are put forward by local communities. That's run very efficiently and very much for the local community. So crime prevention initiatives, all kinds of different community groups are using those funds beautifully. But that's not what it looks like everywhere. So a lot of the people that I spoke to for the project had no idea where the ARIS money was going in their area. They weren't told. Some people were aware that it was being used to support their economic crime units, so with staffing or resources or whatever, and you know, that's absolutely fine, of course, but most people weren't told, and that seems a shame to me.
I think about that in, you know, the context of other government expenditures, let's call it that, because that's essentially what it is once it's confiscated and it's in government custody. I remember driving down a highway somewhere and there was a park in the US and there was a big sign that said your tax dollars at work. Mm-hmm. What would the harm be in putting up a sign that says this project has been funded by proceeds of crime vis-a-vis the work of your judicial authorities? I think part of it's just a messaging issue that we as governments, and it's not exclusive to the UK, US, EU, Asia, Africa, it's all across the board. It's almost like we're apologetic for taking those proceeds of crime and making good of them to a degree. And there's got to be, as I've often said, a paradigm shift in terms of how we think about those proceeds of crime. Do you know of any actual evidence prior to the study that you're working on that demonstrates the theory that asset seizure disrupts and deters crime? Is there any empirical evidence out there?
I mean, there's a bit of a desert when it comes to empirical evidence. So Colin Atkinson did a study back in 2017, I think, like an overall review. And I think they looked at 104 different studies. And basically the conclusion was there is very little empirical evidence of the impact that it has. And part of that is because it's hard. And it's hard to produce a result as well that is palatable. I was going to say digestible, but perhaps I mean palatable to policymakers because people want numbers. And so much of this stuff is very hard to quantify. You're looking at sort of longer term studies. There's certainly work that I would like to do, community focused work on the impact some of this has had on public confidence in law enforcement, especially in the places where the social reuse is going on. It's just that evidence has yet to be gathered. So no, and I suppose in answer to your question, there isn't a lot of empirical work out there at the moment. There is some. And this project that we're working on now, I think, is part of this sort of renewed commitment that we're seeing from the government and from the NCA, which is fantastic, of involving academia and sort of getting engaged with academics to try and fill that evidence gap.
You better pick your entrance song, because this is where Amber Phillips enters the picture and creates some empirical evidence that is a game changer. I mean, seriously, you know, if your new study delivers what you hope and evidence does show that asset recovery genuinely deters offenders and disrupts criminal networks, what would you most want to see change, like, immediately?
Well, I suppose, I mean, a typical academic, I've got to throw a load of caveats in now because, I mean, we're operating in a bit of an empirical desert, and our study is sort of attempting to start to fill some of that gap. So this is an exploratory study that we're doing. So we're qualitative researchers. We're speaking to 30 people who've been impacted by confiscation or forfeiture orders. And we're looking at mapping some of the responses to that. We're looking at deterrence. We're looking at quite rich empirical data, which is going to hopefully serve as a stepping stone, which we can build on in future and which other academics and researchers can, you know, build on as well to start filling up the desert, I suppose, if I'm going to mix my metaphors horribly. But yeah, so I'm not expecting groundbreaking, world-altering change as a result of this, but a step at a time. There's so little empirical research right now that this is just hopefully a step in the right direction to start mapping some of this on uncharted territory.
In beyond the figures, you do list 7 policy recommendations that would have an impact. Among those, what are your top 3 that would have the most impact if adopted? There you go, making you think here towards the end of our discussion.
I mean, the first one I would go to, I guess, is comms, so communication. I mean, asset recovery has a PR problem. There is no question about that. I mean, we've already talked about this, that, and this is partly due to, I mean, I've called it the cultural invisibility of asset recovery, but basically it just means nobody knows about it. Nobody's talking about it. It's not being publicized. And part of that's because it's not really in the cultural imagination. So it's not, you're not seeing Netflix series about financial investigators. There's that new one about civil servants in the 80s, which looks really good that I've not seen yet, which is maybe making a start towards it. There's not much public awareness of, I mean, even the fact that the Proceeds of Crime Act exists, that financial investigators exist, there isn't that public understanding. And that's part of it. And then the media representation of confiscation, when there are media articles about it, they're often not especially positive. I mean, as you said, the confiscation is happening quite a long time after the original conviction happens. So momentum is lost, interest is lost. It's perceived as, again, you get that mysterious dark arts label where as soon as you put the word financial into a story, everybody switches off and starts looking at something else. So developing a more joined up, consistent comms strategy would be quite high on my list. Although, I mean, again, I should say that not everyone's on board with that idea. So there is some hesitance around over-educating the offending population around what POCA can do. So there's a bit of a tension there that needs to be acknowledged. But still, even with that in mind, I think there's more we could be doing to engage with the public around confiscation. So that'd be my first one. My second one is a really nice, quick, easy one, which I've recommended, which is free, which is just to thank the investigators. So it's such as just a stupid, easy, basic thing, but it's not happening enough. And it, again, if you're rewarding people for bringing in these big numbers, regardless of whether that's just a fluke, it's corrosive to morale. And there is an issue at the moment in England and Wales around retention and recruitment of financial investigators. And I'm not saying thank you is going to magically solve this problem. It's a complex problem. But thanking people and rewarding people based on hard work and dedication and effort seems like something that would be relatively straightforward, that wouldn't cost a lot, and that might go some way to kind of bridging that gap, at least for a start. And then I've got one left. I'm going to say, I can't really advocate for the destination thing because I'm sort of suggesting a whole philosophical mindset change, and that's not really a quick win, is it? So maybe then sharing the information with FIs around the destination of those assets, because again, that's not happening in a lot of places, isn't it? And it could be. Again, that's relatively easy and relatively cost effective. And it's just, again, you're finishing the story. So you're telling people. And again, this, I think there's you're talking to Oliver Bullough recently on this podcast. And one of the things in his book is around not telling the banks the result of the suspicious activity reports that they file, because you're not telling people the end of the story. And it keeps coming up. And it's, I think, an important piece of the story.
Some of that too, and this is the only place where I'm going to put a full plug in for Asset Reality. I mean, some of it is embedded within the workflows. There is no unified way to keep track of your seized assets and how to manage them. And I think, like, you know, you'll get a police unit in London working the same criminal organization as a police unit in Wales, somewhere in Wales, like a small unit in Wales. And they're looking at the same organization and they're considering the same assets to a degree, if you're thinking of it from a financial investigations perspective. And they don't have a unified workflow, even though they oftentimes operate within essentially the same national jurisdiction. And if you had some kind of unified technology, I think that would also help with that communications piece. And that's kind of like what Asset Reality is designed for, to bring those kind of workflows into the space. That's, as I told you in our initial discussions, that's the only time I was really going to put a plug in for Asset Reality. But I do think on your communications recommendation, technology could kind of answer that question, because people can go in and see for themselves, hey, what was the status? What's the adjudication on that asset? Because there's a certain point where you enter the seized asset into the system, and then suddenly a prosecutor has control of it. And now it's going through the judicial process, and you can see every step of the way in an automated system like Asset Reality. So, well, Amber, I've got to say, this has been a really insightful conversation, and it's been a true honor to speak with you as well. I remember, as we discussed during our conversation at the beginning of my career, I started thinking that asset seizure was the whole game, and I learned differently over the years. That truly is just the beginning, and that evolution continued even through our acquaintance and our discussion today. And over the last hour, you kind of converted me to a full disciple. I'm going to put my idealist hat back on and pretend like we're going to be able to accomplish this, because I think we are, and it's not going to be pretend. So I want to hear your closing thoughts and find out where our listeners can read and track studies that you might be doing, including Beyond the Figures, and follow any developments that come from it. Amber.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's been absolutely brilliant. So I'm working on a paper at the moment, which is the result of the study that we've been talking about, the Beyond the Figure study. And that, I mean, who knows how long that's going to take to come out, but hopefully not too far. Hopefully that won't take too long. In the meantime, there's a research briefing based on that report that I'm very happy to share. If anyone wants to contact me directly through my LinkedIn page, I'm very happy to share that research briefing with them. The new project that we're working on is due for completion next April. And the final report from that will be not too long after that, hopefully. And yeah, I would say my closing thoughts would be, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. There's a lot of changes in the asset recovery space in England and Wales policy-wise that are reasons for optimism. There's the new Asset Management Office, which is doing some really exciting work around minimising depreciation. I'm really optimistic about that. I think it's sounding really promising. There's the Joint Asset Recovery Database that's going to get replaced soon, which hopefully is going to do something to improve data quality. Again, for researchers, accessing data and getting good quality data is one of the key barriers that we're always experiencing to getting good quality research out there. So I'm excited about the potential of that to help enable some really interesting research in the future. And the new economic crime plan that's coming out. So I think there's a lot of things to be excited about and a lot of reasons to be optimistic, but I would say that, I suppose.
Thank you so much, Amber. Really appreciate it. To our friends, collaborators, and first-time guests listening, Next time you see the photo of the cash on the table, ask the question that nobody's putting in the caption. Where does it go from here? That's the whole ball game. If this conversation scratched the surface for you, if the problems we talked about today, seizing, managing, recovering criminal assets, are problems you're wrestling with, that's exactly what Asset Reality was built for. Reach out at assetreality.com. Join the movement. Change the paradigm underpinning asset recovery. Follow the show. We at Asset Reality, or Asset Recovery is our only mission. Look forward to your next listen. I'm Jason Sandoval. This has been Cease and Desist. We'll seize you next time.
Cease and Desist is produced by Lo Ferner and edited by Tobias Ferner. Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.